Welcome to Chinuch Today. I am your host, Rabbi Yerachmiel Garfield. Please join me as we highlight innovative ideas and inspiring people from the world of Chinuch. Hello and welcome to another episode of Chinuch Today. This is Yerachmiel Garfield, and today's episode once again forges new ground in the Chinuch Today history. And that is because today's episode is a mix of four different micro interviews. Each interview is with a different Talmidah of Rebbetzin Berurah David, whose first Yahrzeit is coming upon us. And for the past year, I've been looking for and interviewing these individuals who could talk to, explain to us who Rebbetzin David was, what made her educational process so unique. Because those of us who are familiar with her know that she was the founding leader of BJJ, which is a major seminary in Eretz Yisrael, that has attracted Klal Yisrael's brightest young ladies who went on to be very successful there, many of them, and then go on to careers in chinuch and leadership, and then went on to build homes that are full of Bnei Torah and Rabbanim and Rishei Kol, etc. And it's really the cream of the crop. We're attracted to BJJ. So what was so unique about BJJ, and what was so special about Rebbetzin David's teaching style and her passion for chinuch and for Torah, for learning, for chumash, for hashkafa? Who was she? What was she about? Something that is very interesting to those of us who never met her or got to hear a shir from her. I did read her dissertation. She wrote a dissertation. She had a doctorate from Columbia in Jewish history. It's available online. It's many, many pages about the Maritz Chias, who is a fascinating figure, and she really goes into many of his writings, historical context, etc. It's fascinating. But other than that, there's very little about her out there in the public sphere. Very much by design of her personality and of her shita, she was extremely private. Even for her Talmidos, as you will hear, they got glimpses into who she was outside of the classroom, but just little glimpses. She was not a very open person in that way. And certainly outside of her BJJ family, if you will, there's so little that's known about her. But those of us who are students of education, we are interested. We want to know, what was it that made her so special? And how did she develop or create this environment of learning? And what were her messages in learning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think many of you will find this episode remarkably interesting because there's so little information out there about her. One of the things that I personally find so fascinating about her is the dichotomy between how religious she was, frumest of the frum, the daughter of Rosh Hashiva, the wife, very much a chashuva Rosh Hashiva, fully part of the yeshiva system and the right-wing ideology. At the same time, she celebrated women's learning, women's intellectualism, women's role, women's voice in Torah study. And I could say that seems to be a unique mix, that one, at the same time, be firmly committed to family, but at the same time, encouraging the girls and the women to open a chumash, to learn. In fact, I was once in a conversation with a Rav about women's learning, and he basically said that although it's not always the case, but in his experience, women who enjoy textual study, who really delve into the intellectual side of learning, it's usually a red flag for hashkafic concerns in other areas. I think Rebbetzin David is remarkable in that she so wasn't that, right? Here's a person who at the same time celebrated textual learning, women's intellectualism, celebrated high-level thinking, deep engagement, and also had such reverence and respect for the yeshiva system. So it's just an interesting persona to look into and how she was able to build this citadel of Torah for women. I'm not sure how to express it other than to say that if it didn't happen, if she didn't do it, I don't think it could have been imagined that it would happen, that you'd have the premier seminary that was producing the cream of the crop, so to speak, of the future of women and education, and it also be the place of the highest intellectual engagement in the textual study of Chumash. It's just an interesting mix. So I hope you enjoy hearing these four different perspectives over four different times. And as you will hear, the difference is remarkably minimal between 1969 and 2007. A few years pass in between, but the product, the person, and the values are very much consistent between those two. I will introduce each person as they come up. Just quickly, the first interview is with Miriam Schachter, who attended the Esther Schoenfeld Seminary from 1969 to 1971. We followed by Mrs. Miriam Gettinger, whose maiden name is Wine, who was at the first year of BJJ, 1973 to 1974. We have Dr. Sarah Nagel, whose maiden name is Tenenbaum. She was at BJJ from 1990 to 1991, which included the Gulf War. And finally, we have Mrs. Rivi Rottenberg, whose maiden name is Geldworth, who attended BJJ from 2007 to 2008. I will introduce each one before their segment. And as I said, you will see over all four of them some things that are different, but what really speaks out loud are some of the values and style that is consistent throughout. I hope you enjoy this special episode of Chinuch Today. Our first interview is with Miss Miriam Schachter, who attended the Esther Schoenfeld Seminary from 1969 to 1971. That seminary was a continuation of the Esther Schoenfeld Girls High School, and it was where Rebbetzin David taught before founding BJJ. Talk about an early interview. I was so thrilled when my brother, Sam Garfield of Silver Spring, told me about meeting her in Europe. I forgot where. Maybe Budapest. He was there for Shabbos, and they started talking, and it came up that she was an early student, and he put us together, and meeting her was such a blast. We had so much fun. She is so interesting and articulate and has great memories of her time there. So I really hope you enjoy hearing from Mrs. Schachter and also appreciating that she was a student when Rebbetzin David was taken hostage, along with her father, the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Hutner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and she was at the airport, as you will hear, upon their return, which is a fascinating aspect of her story as well. So, without further ado, here is Ms. Schachter, an early Talmidah of Rebbetzin David. Well, welcome, Miriam Schachter, a psychologist in private practice in New York, and also a faculty member of Chovei Torah, where she teaches and supports Rabbanim as they go through training and become sensitive to all the many important mental health needs that a rabbi has to know. Wonderful to meet you, and welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Thank you so much. Thank you for welcoming me.
And so I understand that you knew Rebbetzin David a long time ago, and yes, you're here because you're one of the early Talmidos of her, and I'd love to hear how you met her and what the context of that relationship was.
Sure, absolutely. So I went to Esther Schoenfeld High School on the Lower East Side. I grew up in the Bronx. My father, Alav HaShalom, was an extremely prominent Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Herschel Schachter. And he and my mother decided to send us to pretty right-wing yeshivas, and my brother. My brother is Rabbi J.J. Schachter. So
a very special Jew, I must add.
Extraordinarily special Jew. So J.J. actually went to the Yeshiva Philadelphia for high school, and I went to Esther Schoenfeld High School.
And at the time, that was like a right-wing kind of...
It was. It was more to the right. Like, my parents could have sent us to YU schools, to then was Central or MTA, but we didn't. Elementary school, I went to Beis Yaakov, Beis Miriam, and then I ended up... there's a long story about my high school career, which is, we're now here to talk about Rebbetzin David, not about me.
Okay.
So we're going to continue on the Rebbetzin David schlav.
Okay.
So I went to Esther Schoenfeld High School, and I was a pretty serious Torah learner. I enjoyed delving deeper. I'm a kind of serious Jew, and I was even in high school.
Wow.
And so I didn't have to go to seminary. It wasn't like that's what everybody did, but I chose after, even though I went to college at night and I went to seminary during the day. Now, okay, the years.
This is America.
Context. This is the United States, New York, wow. 1969. Wow. I graduated high school in 1969. Rebbetzin David ran the seminary. There were probably not even 20, I'm going to say girls,
wow,
because that's what we were. I was 17 years old, and seminary lasted for 2 years. And I was in seminary for 2 years. I'm 71 years old today, Baruch Hashem. But as you could see, I'm pretty animated and outgoing. And I was like that then as well. I like relationships. I gravitate towards relationships. Rebbetzin David was a reserved woman. I am not. And I kind of made my presence known to her. And I almost insisted that she relate to me, not only through Torah, which was her main mode, but personally. I was taken with her. I was taken with the fact that she was such a melumedes, that she was a woman. I'm a feminist from way back. She was not. She did not define herself that way. I did define myself that way. I didn't put it in her face in that language because, again, remember, I'm 17 years old. Right. I had chutzpah. I definitely had chutzpah, but I was also in awe of her.
Now, so, just to be clear on the timeline, because I should know this, but this is before she moved to Eretz Yisrael and started.
Yes, yes.
If and was this her first job? Was it her?
I don't
seminary?
Know. I don't know. Okay. I don't remember if she taught somewhere before, because again, you have to remember, I'm 17. I didn't think about things that way.
But she was definitely the main teacher or primary.
She was the seminary. It was post high school. It was her.
Do you remember what she taught? What her subjects?
Chumash, Navi, Historia.
Interesting. On the Historia, because that's something that came up all the way through her career. Was it temporary? Was it like the last 100 years? Do you recall?
No.
Okay. No, because one of the things she did in BJJ, certainly towards the second half, was a Historia that focused on Zionism and the early history of Zionism, and she really gave over her Ashkafas in that.
She was living in Yerushalayim, and she was, inculcating her Talmidos in Yerushalayim.
Let's leave the official definition of feminism for the other podcast called Feminism Today, because this is Chinuch Today.
Yes.
Leaving that aside, let us focus on the fact that she respected women's intellectual role in learning Torah. Call that what you will. Is that right?
Correct. And promoted that and had a goal and a stated goal that her Talmidos should learn and should be learned.
I didn't live back, I'm younger than that.
I know. That's good.
I know what
that's
the world was like back then, around the Civil War. But
which Civil War, honey?
But did that have to be justified, explained, contextualized? At that time, was it a given that women...
I want to push back a little bit and say, even in the more right-wing world, I don't think what she was teaching us would have been pushed back on. I think if she was teaching us Gemara and if she was teaching us Gemara on the Daf, that would have been pushed back on.
But the value of saying that you're a woman and your chelik of Torah, so to speak, is a significant piece of your human existence. I think that when we look at the value system and we say, what's important for an Orthodox Jewish woman, a frum, so we say motherhood, nurturing, tefillah.
Big balabusta, you don't know this about.
Okay, but I'm just saying you wouldn't hear in the modern parlance, you wouldn't hear engaging in high-level Chumash study. I don't think you would hear that. Now, you're telling me that was her raison d'etre almost, and I'm just wondering, you're telling me that's normative. I don't see it as normative today, and I'm wondering if it was normative then.
We definitely live in different worlds, you and I.
Yeah.
Certainly in my world, it's more than normative. But I'm going to even say in three steps to the right of me, it's normative.
Okay.
So I don't know. Maybe
and then it was.
It seemed there was no apologetics. It just was.
Okay.
And because of the dint of the force of her character and of her intellect, she didn't need to apologize. People accepted her. She had gravitas. She had standing. She was Rav Huttner's daughter. And she had her own level of learning that it just was. What I want to do is share a story about her hijacking.
Please.
What was
the timeline on that for those listening who aren't as familiar?
I actually did a little Hakira before I got on with you because I had a memory.
We have fact checkers all the time. They write me.
I had a memory, but I wasn't sure my memory was accurate. Okay. So that's why Hashem made the internet. So So we get to check it ourselves. So September, end of September 1970, middle to, I mean, they were released on September 28th, but September 1970 was the hijacking. I was in seminary at the time. I graduated high school in 69. I was in seminary from September 69 to June 71. So September 1970 is the beginning of my second year of seminary.
Wow.
Okay. I am now going to set the stage for you. Okay? So we, obviously we hear about this and we're all zerschmettert. And, you know, so we have Chaim Berlin, literally there are hundreds of Talmidim, but there are thousands of Talmidim, you know, before and who are davening. But then there's us. They're the girls. They're the seminary. And we are also quite distraught and doing our Tehillim thing. It was very, very anxious making. We were frightened. It was kind of tragic. Okay. As the weeks go by, it took a while from the hijacking till the release. It was 2.5 weeks, something like that. We hear it's happening. And because I was an upstart from way back, I tell my chevra, my little group there of girls, that we should go to the airport to greet her. And of course, so we did. Of course, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of boys, of men, right? The entire Chaim Berlin shows up to meet the Rosh Hashiva. And then there's like 15 of us, girls.
Oh, boy.
Okay. And she comes off the plane with her husband and her parents. And she was very shy woman and also somewhat physically awkward. She wasn't like an ebullient warm, but there she was. I felt like it was a nes min hashamayim that she's standing there. And I walked over and I gave her a big hug in front of all, I mean, like they're all standing. And then you don't know, but I'm 5 feet tall. I'm now 4'11", but I'm a little person with a big mouth, but a little person. And I remember embracing her, and she first was very stiff, but then she's taller than me. She was not a tall woman, but taller. Everyone's taller than me. 12-year-olds are taller than me. And then she leaned in. And I remember getting this like look, like this warmth that I think I had always wanted. You know, you always want that from your Rebbe, whether it's a man or a woman. You want that varmkeit. We all look for that. And, you know, Baruch Hashem, I had parents who were extremely attentive and loving, but there's something about from your Rebbe, you want that. Right. And I remember I got it. And but I remember feeling that I needed to help her get there. She wasn't going to come to me, or forget me, us. But I was also very proud because I felt like I modeled for this is what you do. First of all, you're mechubad. This is your Rebbe. This is somebody you come and you give kavod to and you honor and you love. There was a deep hakaras hatov from me to her. She taught me so much. She gave me so much. I was inspired by her Torah. And I wanted her to know. And I was a pisher. I was 18. Greisa knakata. You know? But I wanted her to know. I wanted her to know
how you
that
felt.
She mattered.
So tell me this. She definitely had a regal, austere sort of, I don't know, like noble approach, right? That seems to come across.
Well, regal is a little, I'm going to say, reserved more than regal.
But there wasn't this, like, I know with the Rosh Hashivas, with her father, there was this sort of you and me separatist, like, you know, I'm the Rosh Hashiva, you're the Talmud, and our lanes are very clearly discerned. And I wonder, what I picked up from talking to her Talmidos is that she also had that thing. Like, her personal life was very separate from her professional life. And the human side of her was very much something she didn't share necessarily with her Talmidos. Sounds like, so the question is, was that done because of her personality or because of some kind of ideological cheshbin that this is how you do it?
Okay, so you have to remember who I am. I'm a psychologist.
That's why I'm asking you.
And so I don't remember thinking about it then because I was a child, even though I was quite a mature child, but still, upon reflection, as you know, even in the 5 years post, I thought it was her personality. I also remember being very acutely aware that she had no children. She had no biological children. And I felt, even as a young person, then I was 18, so then I was 19. And by then I graduated seminary, but I had a connection to her, not for many, many years later, but just for a few. I remember thinking that because she had no children of her own, she needed to keep a distance. She needed to hold back because the yearning must have been so powerful and the disappointment must have been so strong that she put herself in the world of, you know, non-biological children. And she gratified the maternal need by having hundreds and hundreds and then ultimately thousands of talmidos. But there must have been a place that inside of her, she was protecting herself. And so she stayed three steps back.
Wow.
Was my interpretation then, and ad hayom hazeh, I believe I'm correct.
Wow, that's a heavy thing to...
And I think it was a heavy thing for her to carry.
Yeah.
And I do believe if she would have lived 50 years later, she probably would have had children. Baruch Hashem, we have, you know, medical field has advanced. Right. And Hashem has smiled on the medical field, and she would have, but she lived when she lived, and for whatever, we obviously don't know what it was all about, but you know, I'm sure this was not, you know, Hashem gave her this nisayon and this is what it was, but it's a heavy burden for a frum woman to carry, not
sure.
to have children.
Did the hijacking impact her? Did she speak about it afterwards? I feel like she's the type just to compartmentalize it and like
correct. So I do not remember much. I do not. After she died, I read about whatever anybody wrote about her.
Not much.
No, not a lot. And because she was so private. And
right.
she really did shy away from publicity. I don't remember her speaking.
Okay. Do you think the fact that she had a PhD, was it something that influenced her thinking, her approach, or was it sort of a side thing? Why did she do it? What was that about?
Well, I think it was her, as you described, intellectual. I think she was a deep intellectual. And I think she, Maritz Chayes, must have piqued her curiosity in a very profound way. And she pursued it. It was not something she spoke about. And it was not something she did inculcate Torah learning in her students. She did not say to her students, now please go get higher education and go get PhDs in Jewish history.
Why do you think she did it? I don't understand. Why would she commit that level of time, focus, and energy to something that was so
central? So now let's think about what her life was. Her life was only intellect. She had no children. She's an only child. That means she had no nieces and nephews. The family life that most of us are so consumed with on a daily basis, so that a PhD is the third extra for us.
Right.
For her, you know, that was her life. So aside from learning Torah and teaching Torah, why wouldn't she? Hmm. What was she filling her world with?
I guess,
but
you know, again, I'm living in the modern world. So, you know, but I can't imagine a Rosh Hashiva of a major Haredi modern institution's daughter in that scenario being like, yeah, I'll go to Columbia and get a PhD in Jewish history.
No,
this is not something you just do. You know,
So I think because of both of their positions in the Jewish community, nobody questioned.
Right.
And she wasn't, you know, standing on the in the quad in Columbia
right.
and carrying on. She wasn't waving and burning. And
her father, I think it's interesting to note that he did spend time in the University of Berlin, famously.
Yes, that's right.
You know,
right.
That's not, again, overly talked
it's
about.
It's not overly emphasized or publicized, but yes.
Right.
Yes,
like
he
maybe
did.
There's something there.
And I think there is something there, and that's a model. And she did it in the most sanua way. She went, she did, she left. She didn't
right.
hang out in the campus. She didn't sit. She didn't chat with the folks.
Right. I figure that there's something there that she felt was beneficial to her. But yet, we can't really see how that carried into the next 70 years
I
of
don't
her
think so.
function.
I don't
So
think
it's
so.
just an interesting thing, you know?
I think it was curious and good and also accessible. She lived in New York. There it was. It was Selah Baron that she got her doctorate with, I believe. I'm pretty sure. He was there before Chaim. So my husband got a PhD from Columbia. So, but it was later in the early 80s. So he finished in the early 80s, but he was there in the 70s.
Do you
So
know if she
Selah
had
Baron.
any female role models that she referred to, that she was like modeling her interest in
Not much.
learning, her
We're
teaching?
talking 55 years ago. I
So
mean,
maybe she would quote the person. Maybe she was a big quoter of someone, the Chaim Leibowitz or something like
Shneira,
that.
Sarah Shneira. I don't know.
I don't know. That's what I'm asking. I don't
I
think
don't
she
know.
had Sarah
I don't know.
Schneider, right?
I'm not. No.
Did she leave any Talmidos who you would say embody her approach fully? Who's her big
I don't
Talmidos?
know.
She has a
Who was?
million Talmidos, but
That's right. So I don't know who the.
heir apparent of her, like, you
Yes,
know,
I
is
don't know
she?
who is now running BJJ. I don't know, but there must be, and I wonder if they did learn with
Right.
her. I don't
I
know.
didn't get that sense that her, you know, she, I think because she was so unique, it's like one of those things, just like
Right,
dichotomy.
emulate or duplicate.
Was her goal that you would continue to learn all of your life at that level? Was it the kind of thing like she wanted to teach you and then on a Friday night you'll sit at the couch, open up Chumash Sefarno, or she felt like I'm teaching you now so you know the Amkus of Torah, now go live your life?
I think she wanted, I mean, it wasn't the same emphasis as we would give the boys of Kuvei Ha'itim. It wasn't because that was not the time. I got the feeling that she wanted us to continue to learn, whether it's a half hour a day or once a week, or that she did want Torah to be a part of our ongoing active life. Not you're in seminary, drop it, you know, have babies and, you know, take care of your husband. Yes, that, but not only that.
Since she had such a awareness of the power of Torah and the depth of her experience, how could you not want someone to access that throughout their
Yes,
life?
and
I mean,
I think she did. I think she
right.
did. I do think, again, we're talking decades ago. So, you know, putting myself in my 17, 18, 19-year-old head. But I do remember her love of Torah was palpable, and she did transmit it. And I'm sitting here at 71 years old, and I can feel the feeling.
Wow, unbelievable. Some of her Talmidos have mentioned like pointed Musar or real strong redirection that she had given them at a certain time, at a certain point. Did you ever experience that you remember where she like said, "Listen here, Miriam, I don't know exactly," she wouldn't say like that, but
No, she wouldn't. But I also didn't avail myself to ask her Hashkafic kinds of questions. I came from a family with very strong values that taught me in great depth. And I also had a strong mind of my own. And I wasn't looking for an Hashkafic guidance. I wasn't. I was looking to learn Torah. And I made that distinction. So, no, I wasn't going to look to her to say, should I get married? I mean, I got married at 19. I was very young, so she would have definitely supported that. But I didn't look to her to say anything. Not for halachic decisions, not for hashkafic. I didn't, and so I didn't leave room for her to do that for me.
Interesting. I mean, that's pretty mature for a young girl to not feel the need to
Yeah.
engage, like to prove themselves right or to, you know.
No, I didn't. I can't. You know, I don't know if you know anything about my father, but my father was a
Little bit. I
powerhouse
read the
Jew.
book.
Okay, you read the book. You read the book.
I read the book, The Rabbi of
Okay,
Buchenwald.
the bearer of that was my father. I mean, he's a powerhouse of a man. And my mother, who is not written about, had the convictions. She lived an intentional ideological life. And she was a true humanist and a true Ohev Torah. And she was Kovei Etim LaTorah. And she also covered her brios was her mainstay. So I came from a very strong influence. I didn't need, and then I morphed it into my own as an, you know, as I progressed and matured and adultified and my husband and, you know, we made our own very much. Somewhat like my parents, but also separate from it. My name is Miriam Schachter. I didn't take my husband's name. in 1972, when there wasn't a person who was from that I knew alive that did not take their husband's name. Lo haya velo nivra. Okay?
You're machadish.
And it was me. Okay? I was a Kanakata from day one.
Did you keep in touch with her over the years? Did you guys follow up?
No.
Nothing? You haven't seen her since 1971?
She went to Eretz Yisrael. I did not. I did not.
Would that be of interest to you? Like, with now in retrospect, do you wish you visited her in 85 and 93 and 2002, 2015? What would you talk about?
Excellent question. I think by then I would have thought she would have been highly disapproving of me. And I don't know that I wanted to expose myself to that.
Wow.
Because I moved in a very,
right, different direction, if you will.
From Sheba Frum, but not how she would have defined it.
Right.
And I wanted to maintain the kind of the sanctity of
beautiful.
What was. And I didn't want to expose myself to what I thought would have been negative judgment from her to me. Because I believe Be'emuna Shlema that I'm doing what's good for me and what's good
right.
for Klal Yisrael.
Right.
But I don't know that she would have. I'm not sure I wanted that.
And going back to that time period, I'm just remembering to follow up on this. When she was in Columbia, was she particularly close to her advisor or nothing?
I have no idea because, again, I'm her Talmida. I'm 17 years old. She's 30-something. I didn't talk to her about her academics. I don't even know. I have no idea.
Okay.
And she really kept it under wraps. I remember.
Right. How about her father? Did she quote her father a lot? Was he a bigger-than-life figure in the discussions?
She did make reference. She referred to him as the Rosh Hashiva. But it was not overly.
Got it. But she did hold herself as separate, right? But it wasn't with the gaiva. It was more of like
it was a dignity, a little dignity. And I felt shy. I felt there was a lot of shy. She wasn't so comfortable. She was comfortable in the role of teacher because you had a medium and a message and a methodology. You know, you could teach Torah. I'm sure you know many rabbis like this who, you know, when they're speaking from the pulpit, they're passionate and they're engaging, but put them at a Shabbos table and they're, you know, there's something about, she was shy.
Did you know anything about her mother? I don't know anything about her mother.
I don't know anything about her mother.
Okay, wonderful.
And she didn't talk about her mother.
Well, thank you so much. This is a wonderful interview. And
thank
I'm so happy that you shared. And it's so cool to be able to talk to someone who knew her back in the day.
Back in pre-bait BJJ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is exclusive. Schoenfeld. Another Chinuch Today exclusive. thank you so much.
Raphael, you're fun. You're totally fun.
Thank you. I'm sure it's obvious to you now how much I enjoyed that interview, getting to know Mrs. Schachter, hear about her story. The next interview is with Mrs. Miriam Gettinger. Mrs. Gettinger has been a mechaneches, a principal, for nearly 40 years. Currently, she's at the Haston Hebrew Academy in Indianapolis, previously in South Bend. And she was at BJJ for the first full year of its existence, 1973 to 1974. And something that's very special about Mrs. Gettinger is that she is a real educator herself, who really understands St. David in the context of Chinuch and how it shaped her, her educational model, and her thoughts. And I'm sure you'll enjoy this interview as well with Mrs. Miriam Gettinger. Hello, it's wonderful to welcome Mrs. Miriam Gettinger, who is the head of school in Indianapolis. Welcome to the Chinuch Today podcast. We're going to talk about Rabbitson Beria David Alea Shalom. Thank you for joining us. So when did you meet Rabbitson David?
A pleasure to be here to discuss my Isha Anakit, so to speak, the Rabbitson, who in many ways made an indelible impression upon me, both personally and professionally. I was zocha to meet Rabbitson David as in her first year in Israel, heading the Mahon, or what is called BJJ. I was in that very first class.
Wow, that is unbelievable.
I don't want to date myself, but Lamed Gimel, Of course, I was very precocious. No, I was 18 years old, just 18, and had the schluss to be in that first class.
How did you end up in that first class? Like, what was, did you know you wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, or what was up with that?
At that time, there were exactly 2.5 seminaries in Eretz Yisrael, but it was a something of obviously growing up in a home where Eretz Yisrael was important as a value when that became an option after high school. I will tell you that most of the reason that I chose BJJ was not the reason that I would have chosen it in retrospect. But at that time, that was one of the two choices that any of my friends, any of my peer age group at that time, I was in Hannah Sachs, Beis Yaakov of Chicago. That was one of the places that many of them were going. I was going also with a cousin, one of the Keller girls, Leah, and that was, the basis, so to speak, of my informed decision.
Was it hard to
realize at the time how special that opportunity would be?
Was it hard to get into back then? Like, it developed over time?
No, it was absolutely. I wouldn't say it was hard to get into at that time. Again, our class was very formative in setting the bar for the excellence and the academic standards. And very beautifully, in my time, there was one girl from Lakewood. There were about 70 of us in the seminary, one from Lakewood, a handful from Brooklyn, but from all over the United States. So at the time, there were probably 15 of us taken from Chicago, which doesn't happen today.
Did she market the seminary as some kind of, not elitist, but high intellectual, or did she market it in any particular way at the time? Or was it like, come to a seminary?
Right. I don't think that it was really done necessarily in that way. The notion of spending a year in Eretz Yisrael for the growth academically, but more importantly in Ruchnius, was a very novel concept at that point.
Was there a bechina to get in? Did you have to take a test?
At that point, there was only potentially the reading the Ramban, but we didn't have to travel to New York or go through the hoops that others would have to go into,
So had you met Rebbetzin David before you?
No. As a matter of fact, I did not have the schluss to meet her until I was actually in Eretz Yisrael at the seminary was when I met her for the first time.
Wow, that's really amazing. First of all, I mean, people don't realize that you're really a pioneer in the whole seminary movement, right?
Yeah. I suppose so in many ways. I will share that, and this is a very telling statistic, 90 or above percent of current menahalos of seminaries or schools in the United States, women, that is, are Mahon BJJ graduates.
Wow.
So they're not as old as me, obviously. And my daughter, Baruch Hashem, is one of them as an example.
Wonderful.
But that is absolutely a very telling statistic. And I think that the seminary from the beginning, one of the uniquenesses of Rebbetzin David, what at that point, especially in Chinuch, was that she was such an unbelievable milumedes and emphasized critical and creative thinking skills from the beginning.
Wow.
So that was, I don't know if we could say this, but the other major seminary at that point was Michlala or Mahon Gold existed at that point. But I think that was, at the time, was certainly for students who were looking for more of an Israel experience rather than a specific tremendously high academic an opportunity to really immerse oneself in Limud HaTorah.
And Rebbetzin David was the primary teacher in the seminary?
She was the director of the seminary. She also taught two critical subjects that till today, her lessons have shaped me. I actually have in my possession, despite moving numerous times, I have my seminary notes. I have my notebooks for Eretz Yisrael from 50 years ago.
Wow.
That's how valuable they were. Can't say I've referred to them, but that was meaningful to me.
What were the subjects that she taught?
She taught Chumash and Historia.
Wow.
So Chumash was in Sefer Devarim from Perek Yud Gimel and on. And Historia was modern Jewish history understanding the birth of the state of Israel and what that meant, so to speak, to the Yishuv HaYashan and everything from that point. It was a very critical lens for me to understand. I had been to Israel before, Baruch Hashem, and since then many times, and her perspectives obviously were very significant in shaping many things, but especially in that way.
Why do you think she started in the middle of Devarim for where to teach Tanakh?
She had been a premier milumedes and mechaneches in the Esther Schoenfeld Seminary in the United States before. So I never asked. That wasn't an opportunity. But I think more than anything, for girls to have an exposure to a Chumash that they had not really studied in depth up until that point.
Got it. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And did you get to have a personal relationship with her during that experience?
I did. I'm going to say that Rebbetzin David was the daughter of Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, whom my husband was very close to, and Rebbetzin David was actually my personal shatran.
Wow.
So I had that, you know, relationship. But obviously earlier, what I mean to say, what is unique, is that Rav Huttner studied under the Alter Mislabotka. And for him, if we know that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rabbi Finkel, again, Zichronam as Tzadikim Livracha, all were under that same, in that same yeshiva, so to speak, or had that personal relationship, that was the altar, very much individuals and building a relationship with individuals. So that hallmark was transmitted to Rebbetzin David. And I'm not going to say everyone had the same relationship, but she sought very unique personal relationships with each of the girls. And the diversity was extremely important. In my time and in my class, not only did girls come from all over the United States, Europe also, there were a number of girls from different European countries. But I think that developing a personal relationship was a critical aspect of her role of what the seminary experience would be like.
Amazing. How did she cultivate the relationship outside of the classroom, or how did that work?
Both within and outside of the classroom, but the outside of the classroom was very, very much a component. She spoke with girls regularly. I don't know. I guess she had a schedule, so to speak, and girls had the opportunity to go and discuss things with her. And then she was famous for her outside shiurim. Besides the classes that were given, there was an opportunity on a certain night of the week to come to her home, to her apartment. At that time, it was, you know, right near the seminary, or, well, not quite, in the Unsdorf neighborhood. And that's where she gave this. It was an optional class, but that was a time that she was larger than life, so to speak. And we had the opportunity not only to learn Pachad Yitzchak and other things, but to really develop a more personal relationship with her. My own relationship developed not only during the seminary year, but of course, as I'm mentioning, afterwards, and both personally, as I said, shidduchim, but more importantly, and in other ways, professionally, I maintained that relationship with her over the years and found that very helpful, the perspective once again, and I'll share one of the insights that was so meaningful to me. Again, remember, I'm 18 years old at the time, and I didn't grow up in a yeshivish world. And so the idea of a Rosh Yeshiva or having a Rebbe Muvhak, so to speak, was not ever part of my experience. And so this was obviously not only an impressional, but such a schus, such an idea, so life-changing, I'm going to say, in many, many ways. So, you know, one of the things that I felt all along was she was such a persona that while there was warmth and she would reach out to Talmidos, there was also the obvious yira, understanding in whose presence. She was obviously not a melumedes of having thousands of Talmidos at that point, as will later be. But I always felt in her presence that I needed to say something profound. Whether in the classroom, this was not sichas chulin type of conversation ever. although she was always very personable and would ask, how are you? That type of thing. So throughout my career, I felt that I needed to say something profound. So much so that I remember my first year back from seminary, I went to a friend in Borough Park for Simchas Torah, for the last days of Yom Tov, especially to walk into Chaim Berlin and to experience Simchas Torah there. As you know, maybe they do Hakafos in the afternoon very differently than other places. And I remember what I said afterwards to Rebbetzin David, because I felt like, okay, profound, that up until that point in my life, I had seen Simcha in Simchas Torah, unfortunately in a shul way, sometimes holulus. But this was the first time that I really had the opportunity to recognize Kavod HaTorah in Simchas Torah. I was very proud of myself. Additionally, later, I'm going to say maybe I was there, as I said, 50 years ago, but maybe 25 years into that relationship, I had the opportunity to visit her in Eretz Yisrael in the seminary. And I remember asking what I considered a valuable for me. I asked it personally and professionally, but again, it gave me great insight. I asked her what she sees as a difference in Talmidos over this period of time. Okay, 20 years, 25 years later. And I have Demus Diukna in front of me always. And she said, every school has a chesed program, and we have built that in to girls' chinuch. You must do chesed. But when it comes to the idea of a commitment, of amelus, that sometimes just because you say you're going to do something, and then it's hard, it's not convenient, where is that amelus? An amelus and a commitment and achrayus, the importance of words, which is also very much a legacy of Rebbetzin David that all Talmidos will say, she said. And it was, again, it was an important understanding that we're so busy emphasizing and mandating almost and structuring chesed, but we don't necessarily think and the significance of achrayus, especially to seminary girls and to pre-seminary girls as they're contemplating marriage and careers, that this is a very, very important she'ifa for them to understand what does it mean, this concept of amelus, to really, really stick with something, even when it's difficult or, you know, and in today's world, you and I know, alachas kama v'kama, where when the wind blows, you know, this, I can't, it's too hard, I don't want to, I'm not in the mood, is something that was very, very much a Rebbetzin David legacy that I got.
I assume her father was her primary teacher that gave her this derech, but would you say that with regard to the way she taught women and the level of intellectual engagement that she sort of demanded or raised her students to, where did that come from? Was that her own creation? Did her father tell her to do that? Like,
I can't say. I don't really know. I do know how close she was to her father, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and that her legacy to girls, that the Rambam talks about Limud HaTorah and Kavod HaTorah, so that what she had shown us, again, Demus Diukna, was Chashivos HaTorah. And that was such a novel concept. Remember 50 years ago, marrying someone who was going to sit and learn was not what it is today, not a given at all. And so and those were amongst the values and conversations that, you know, that she brought out and shared with us. So I'm assuming that, and I know amongst the wonderful things that she would talk about, she'd often, of course, quote the Rosh Yeshiva. And I myself at the beginning didn't know, because I didn't have this background, to whom she referred, but was quickly schooled in that to learn. But she taught numerous concepts from Pachad Yitzchak came out. And for her, Yomim Tovim, Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim, and what every Yontif meant. To me, it was very telling, obviously, the Hashgacha that Nebuch she Niftarah on Chol HaMoed Pesach of all times. I remember even knowing that she would speak about that once a girl had asked her, not necessarily in my time, I think, about whether somebody could go to visit a Holocaust museum as a Holomoid trip to Yule. And her reaction of being horrified by that, that wow. If you understand what Yontif is, you wouldn't ask that question, so to wow. speak. So that would be, so these kinds of things would come up.
I am not so familiar with the Masorah of Sarah Schneer and the focus that's put on like learning Chumash with great intensity and intellect. How did she see women's role in Limud HaTorah? Did she see it as a tool or as some kind of kiyum of Talmud Torah? Like, did she expect you to continue learning your whole life? How did she view the role of Torah for women? And was that unique to her, or is that just the Beis Yaakov movement?
No, I think it was very unique certainly at the time. Remember that everything, BJJ became the mother that spawned all of these other types of seminaries, etc. So I think that the tafkid of a woman was something she talked about regularly. Once again, chashivos haTorah as different from limud haTorah. But as an example, not that being said, not only kavod haTorah and understanding that asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim and what that means, what the role of a yid is and what the role of klal Yisrael and hamavdil ben Yisrael la'amim, all of these things, were stark, so to speak, in her messaging to the girls. Very, very important. We're coming up in Mirz Hashem on the Yontif of Shavuos, and she was notorious for saying, not only in my year, but from that on, that girls and women should not only focus, this is Matan Torah, how are we preparing for Kabbalah Satorah? Not only cheesecake and blintz recipes, but are you going to open a sefer? Are you going to open a sefer? So that was very important. And the schooling in Mefarshim and how to learn Chumash was bedafka for that point, so that girls would not just, rely on husbands, this is before Art Scroll or anything else, but would have the tools to learn and to have that chashivus and that she'ifa for themselves and their family to be immersed in Limud HaTorah.
Did she write any original chidushim or books or sifrei svarim on Chumash? Is there anything published from her own learning?
Not that I am aware of. She did write for her father. She was the one who actually did Ksav Yad, literally, the original volumes of any number of what then became his svarim and the Pachad Yitzchak.
Did she say her own chidushim around...
I'm going to say not what we would call chidushim, but the emphasis, the hashkafos, and blending them in. In her Chumash class, there was the regular notebook and then the margin, what went in the outside. Mm-hmm. And that's what was, alive, electric, and very, very powerful. Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed me with a near photographic memory. It's a gift. It didn't come. And with it that my father, Baruch Hashem, has it and his father. So you know where it came from. But so I happen to remember, again, critical thinking, that one day she had some business thing to discuss with us about a list of girls. And it was less girls were going to do a certain thing than the majority. And she came in and said, how do you connect this to a Rashi that you prepared in Re'eh? And I knew it. And that was that Rashi is going to list, or the Torah is going to list, the behemos, tahoros, rather than tameos and chayos, because horet es hamiut. So that, okay. But what I really remember, of course, are all the things in the outside margin, which were things like limudim, engagement rings. That's not something that's very personal, that's part of the tznius, is that you don't brag about it and show it off to everybody and tell all the details of how the engagement went, that you don't walk around the streets of Yerushalayim eating a piece of pizza or an ice cream cone, that is not, it's not a question of tznius, that is not the mahus of a Bas Yisrael, so to speak. So all of that was in the outside section of the notebook.
Amazing.
So I don't know if that helps answer.
Yeah, sure does. This commitment, you mentioned the high percentage of her students are giving back and serving in Kli Kodesh. How did that come about? Was that talked about? Did she really emphasize that? Or is it like self-selection that the kinds of people who go there, how did that evolve?
Again, I can't say, you know, definitively, but I assume it's more the latter. The types of girls who were most interested in such Aliyah Ruchni, but at the same token, the learning, the standards of learning, and understanding this tafkid of women and the next Doros and giving over to Doros, I believe would have been, you know, the ones who would have applied and the ones who would have been accepted to that. And so I don't want it to sound as an elitist thing, but it came about more in that way than her talking about it. It's not like learn, earn, return, you know, message, right, as much as that was the essence of being around a person like that. Of course, I was inspired by my family, but I was more so inspired, I'm going to say, to go into chinuch and stay with it. As you well know, there are moments that there are jobs out there that would be a whole lot less stressful and everything else. But that stick-to-itiveness to this mission was especially from, I felt, a unique Yanika, so to speak, from Rebbetzin David in this, that is something that to give over. One of the very special sensitivities that she brought across, it actually was through Pachad Yitzchak on Pesach, of Loshinu es Lashonam. And that she often would speak about his Romamus and Godlus and who we are and what our She'ifo should be in that way. But in that, the idea that we were as a nation Murumam as a result of Loshinu es Lashonam, that is like, you know, iconic or classic Rebbetzin David. So what she would, you can never say the word whatever around her. There's nothing that's not. Lashon is to be precise. She was very, very meduyak in her Lashon, very careful. Let alone expressions like, which I found myself when my granddaughters last Pesach were visiting and go to the best premier Beis Yaakovs in this country, and some use the expression of heaven. This is heaven. They were talking about, I don't know, food,
chocolate cake,
or
no less, yes,
or an experience or something like that. I thought to myself, wow, that this grates on me so is a legacy all the way back from Rebbetzin David. And those types of things. Interestingly, I heard a hesped that was given, and one of the Talmidos had mentioned something related to this, and then said, you know, there was an ad in the, you know, all the Pesach circulars for some yogurt or something, and it said, you know, b'chol hamarbe, and it's a picture of these yogurts, whatever, begodim or something, ha'raise them eshubach. Oh, she would have tittered from such a thing. The sensitivity to the language and the way we use things. I know she taught me that, and Baruch Hashem, I assimilated that we, one should never say to die for. We don't talk like that. That's not the beauty of Lashon HaKodesh
and being refined, a refinement.
Not refined ever to speak in those ways. So that's an example of something that stayed with me.
Was she in any way sentimental? I mean, she, you know, I don't hear that about her much. I'm curious, is there anything that like would touch upon her heartstrings that you
Yes,
see?
I feel that connection to previous Doros and then the next. So in other words, when my daughter went to seminary and then Baruch Hashem, a granddaughter, when that is something of sentimental value. Mishpacha, or those who had relationships with Chaim Berlin, also very sentimental. And there were, in my seminary year, there were girls who had a Chaim Berlin connection and they had a special relationship with Rebbetzin David, I would say. So it would be there as well.
Were there any unique aspects or rules about the seminary that would make the seminary experience unique? Like, she made sure in my seminary, X, Y, and Z would happen. Does anything come to mind?
I don't see it in terms of rules, because again, she would emphasize the intrinsic. The girls who are a BJJ girl, so to speak, a Mahon student, there are certain just protocols and conducts of behavior that are intrinsic, that I would say. Questions could be asked at any point. That was very much emphasized, which was, I think, a beautiful and important limud. Discernment, that motif over and over, whether it's Ben Yisrael La'amim, Ikar and Tafel, in our lives and our priorities, was very much a part of who and what she would, you know, tell us about. Another thing that I felt and appreciated, and professionally now, al achas kama bakama, she had enormous kavod for each of the teachers. And the teachers were eclectic. Baruch Hashem, we had Rav Shamshon Fall Weiss for Hashkafa class, Rav Neivert, the author of Shmir HaShabbos Kelchasa for Halacha, Gveret Castell at the time, and then she became Gveret Leibowitz. So a Talmida, two Talmidos of hers taught. And then we had holdovers from the original Beis Yaakov Seminary. All right. So, and the kavod that she showed each in their own way, complimenting them, seeing their strengths, is halavai, that I should be able to emulate that. And I've really tried professionally to always see the strength, because the weaknesses glare at you. That's for sure. You don't have to work very hard to see them, but to see the strengths and channel the strengths, I feel is something that I had that unique opportunity to observe.
Did Rabbi Huttner ever visit the seminary? Or
no,
did you?
No.
All right, this is great. Is there anything else that you want to mention about her as we sort of wrap up?
I guess just one other thing.
Yeah.
And maybe because my father, Shlita, always talks about Reb Mendel Kaplan, and that he would read the Chicago Tribune, and that they taught him maybe about baseball and other things, but he taught them how to understand the world. Rebbetzin David was very attached to newspaper clippings, very much. So in Historia, often that would be on the test. That was my first experience with non-memorized, imagine any strategic thinking, that she would put in a clipping and you would have to relate it to something that you learned.
Wow.
But importantly, she used the lens of advertisements and all types of newspapers as a forum for discussion. So understanding that and seeing the world, again, that discernment, where is the MS? Again, 50 years before fake media, was an incredible, incredible legacy also that I feel that I get.
Did she have any hobbies, or do you have a sense of what she did for fun?
One thing I can tell you, Rabbi Garfield, Rabbi David was all about reverence. and she would consider it an irreverent, so to speak, question.
Okay.
I will share with you that she very much enjoyed hosting and hospitality. And so cooking and baking, she went out of her way Hanukkah time to create 16 different types of latkes type of thing. But I would not have been privy to any of that. She also was a tremendous academician in the general sense. She has a PhD from Columbia, and she wrote about the Maratz Chayos. Never spoke about that during seminary. Never.
Got it. Okay, wonderful. I actually read it. I downloaded it and read it.
But,
yeah, it's
okay.
Quite
so you know
extensive. That. It's quite an extensive piece.
Yes.
Available on a good database. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for the time and for, you know, it's amazing how someone for 50 years was able to be mashpia in such a consistent way, you know, to be able to produce what she had. And it's a real schuss that you started out her career, right? Look at that.
Thousands of Talmidos. And as we said, and Doros of Talmidos is something very special. Also, as we know that Nebuch, she was not Zocha to children, but the Talmidos, Elu Habanos. That's
if ever that's fulfilled, it certainly would
very
be
much,
there.
Very, very much.
Okay. All well, right. Thank you so much.
My
thank
pleasure.
You. All
thank
the best.
You. Thank you.
Okay. 1973 to 74 was 50 years ago. And to hear Mrs. Gettinger continue to talk about her teacher, her Mora, with such vibrancy and appreciation, love, and impact says so much about what Rebbetzin David was able to do with her Talmidos and the impact that she had. The next interview is with Dr. Sarah Nagel, maiden name was Tenenbaum. She was at BJJ from 1990 to 91, and together with her husband moved to Houston, Texas 25 years ago, where they have been building Torah. As you will hear, Dr. Nagel is a very thoughtful person and also brings such vibrant memories of her year in BJJ with Rebbetzin David. Welcome, Dr. Sarah Nagel, a longtime resident of Houston who's involved in all Kli Kodesh with her wonderful husband, Rabbi Yaakov Nagel, both in the Shul and the Kollel and many different things going on in the city. I know you were a Talmida of Rebbetzin David a long time ago, and I appreciate you joining me.
Sure. It's my privilege and honor. Rise to the occasion.
Thank you. Thank you. So tell me, where did you go to high school and how did you choose BJJ as a place to go?
So I went to Prospect Park Yeshiva, now Benos Leah Prospect Park Yeshiva. At the time that I was in 12th grade, there were very few seminaries to choose from. There were really just a handful. And Prospect Park was very big on individualized chinuch. Every student met throughout their high school years, met privately with the principal, Rabbi Kramer, talked about what your goals were for high school. And then when we got to 12th grade, we had an individual meeting. And then we also had a meeting with our parents together with Rabbi Kramer. And the goal was really to look at where we've come, you know, where each Talmida grew to, what level she had grown to, what were her goals were in life, and then to talk about next steps after college. So they, after high school, they did, Prospect Park did not view the school's mission as stopping after Talmida graduated in 12th grade. But until this day, I have a relationship with my teachers, with Rabbi Kramer. I call them anytime. And that thing with my parents and Rabbi Kramer, we discussed the seminaries that were appropriate for me. I had one teacher who was a Mechlala graduate who was very, very much was pushing me to attend Mechlala. To my father, it was really his main goal was what seminary would most likely instill in me a desire to marry Ben Torah. Mm. And Rabbi Kramer answered unequivocally, that would be BJJ. And so not that it's not possible, Michala, at the time, but I guess it was a more mixed outcome. And I see I sent two of my daughters to Michala. It's much more, you know, it's much more independent in terms of exposing the girls to different, different valid pathways. And BJJ was more single-minded in its purpose, which I always say. Its purpose of what they wanted their Talmidos to come out. And so, you know, I grew up in a Kollel family. My father learned in Kollel for many, many years before It was in my grandfather's sat and learned their entire lives. So that's the type of home and the type of model I was exposed to. My father wanted that to continue for me. So that was the only seminary I applied to.
Wow.
And, you know, Rebbetzin David did a lot of homework before she even met a potential candidate for an interview. So by the time I came to the interview, she knew my father had learned in Slabodka. She knew my grandfather, you know, had learned in Kamenetz in Europe. She knew my great uncle was an Altamir who helped found Beis HaTalmud. And she brought all those things up in my interview. So I think her goal was to establish sort of a really deep sense of pride. This is where you came from, you know? Mm. And that was always her overarching message. Ben Torah was the ideal.
Was it like scary for you?
Scary. So we knew that we would be put on the spot, you know, open up the Chumash to so-and-so Pasuk, read the Pasuk, now go to the Ramban, read it, explain it. She wanted to see if we had a good grasp of not just understanding the words, but also an understanding of where to pause while reading it. So, you know, she was kind of looking for those skills. And even if you didn't know every single word, but if you got the gist of it and asked, you know, okay, I understood this much. You wanted to also see if you, you know, had an interest in learning. That was, I think, her goal, not just that you knew it, but that, you know, you wanted to understand it.
So you show up the first day, ready to go. Did you know what to expect? I mean, was it what?
So, you know, I had friends that had gone before me. Rebbe Sadeva was, you know, pretty legendary. I'll tell you, she was a very private person. She didn't speak publicly at all. She really only taught, and she gave alumni classes afterwards, but it was strictly for alumni. I think I managed to attend one where I graduated and was still living in New York. I attended one, but she didn't speak to the masses. She never just opened up. She was a very private person.
Did she preach for others not to, or was it just like her personal preference, or was it like a value?
That was her personality. She was just a very private person. I don't think she enjoyed public speaking, but she had a real passion for chinuch. And so to her talmidos, she taught, but it wasn't like she gave classes, you know, to the public. Her style was also very, I like to say, it was kind of like a drip irrigation methodology. She didn't preach. She didn't give these fiery talks. You know, she would drop these comments throughout the year. And my own kids know I have certain sensitivities that develop because of it. For example, you know, the Shabbos Seuda, she would say, this is Seuda. You don't call it Shabbos lunch. Like, she would just kind of fit it in to, I don't know how it fit in, but yeah. Like, throughout the year, we would probably hear that 100 times. And so, you know, you graduate BJJ and like somebody says Shabbos lunch and it's like, ooh, you know, it's not a lunch, it's a Seuda. You know?
I imagine when you moved to Houston some time ago, that was common vernacular.
My children know it's not Shabbos lunch, it's the Shabbos Seuda.
That relates to pride though, right? To seeing it for something elevated.
Well, I'll tell you, she gave me a very personal message at the end of the year, and it really tied all this together. Another example would be, you know, a sefer. Somebody would refer to a sefer, a chumash or a navi, as a book.
Right.
You know, just gathering up my books. A sefer. So, and also she would say, you know, when you come home and your Talmud Chacham husband has Svarim all over the house, you don't say, what's all this mess? Svarim is not a mess. Svarim is, you know, like, is the home's just most amazing adornment. You know, she would say comments like that. And she would repeat them. She would drop them over and over and over. By the time you graduate over the year, you know, those were just so, those sensitivities were just very entrenched. She would say comments like, what's wrong with, don't throw your garbage in my backyard. And everybody.
Oh, that expression, you mean?
Like, what? Like, what are you getting at? Like, sometimes you wouldn't quite know what she was getting at. I guess that was like an old time song, sort of like, you know, 100 bottles of beer on the wall. Yeah. So same genre. She would say like, what's wrong with that? And we would like, you know, try to come up with, okay, what could be wrong with that? She'd say, they're just silly. Why are you wasting your brain space on silliness? You know, when you have children in Meretz Hashem, why sing silly songs with them? You could be singing Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. So those are like, you know, little sensitivities. She would harp over and over and over, but it's, you know, like they seep in and, you know, you develop a sensitivity for it. We met with Rebbe Sadeva. Every student met with her during the year. I don't recall at all, but I was rereading some of my letters that I got from my aunts and uncles and grandparents during my year. And one of them referred to my meeting with Rebbe Sadeva mid-year, but I have no recollection of that. But at the end of the year, that one I remember, were invited to her apartment, and she gave a personal message to each talmida. So she knew I was planning on going to college afterwards. So her message to me, and afterwards I found out she told this to many, many other talmidos, but she said, you know, always as you go through life, always remember the distinction between Kodesh and Chol. You know, you could go through college, you could work secularly. She actually was very open-minded. Many of my fellow BJJ graduates ended up getting advanced degrees. They're very successful professionally. She herself had a PhD in history. I'll talk a little bit about some of her history classes. She was brilliant. And she really was very open to that. But she always maintained that you had to keep that distinction in mind always. So, you know, she gave examples. Don't study secular studies or read secular books on Shabbos. You know, Shabbos. For Kodesh and Chol is for Chol. So things like that, I always try to keep that in mind. She taught very intentionally. She would teach us Chumash, but then she would also, you know, open up her folder and take out this newspaper clipping, that newspaper clipping, a letter from a former Talmida. She would curate all these things and weave them in. So the lesson from Chumash would tie into something happening in current events, or a letter from a former Talmida who was going through a particular challenge, or, you know, for, I never wrote her, but there were Talmidos who would write her, you know, things that they noticed in the workplace or this or that. She would weave it into whatever she was teaching.
She called her father a lot. Do you remember?
She would say the Rosh Yeshiva, something like from the Rosh Yeshiva. She would quote her father. It's interesting. I was there during the Gulf War. So it was a very unique time, I think, because we were a group of about 100 students and about 70 left. So for a few months, we were about 30 girls remaining. And Rebson David never canceled class at all. We had class every single day for a few weeks. I remember when things were really bad and the Scud missiles were coming over, I think we used to dorm in one building and then walk about a mile to the school building. But there were classrooms in the dorm building. So I think for a couple of weeks, you know, she came to us, and which was nice. But I don't think we missed a day, you know. Yeah. She's like, Torah goes on. So that was...
Did she encourage you to learn your whole life? Was that part of her mission?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. She really had a... Intellectual curiosity was a foundation for her. It was very foundational. And she, I think she felt very strongly that you couldn't appreciate a husband who's a Ben Torah if you did not also keep up with learning. Mm. So I can't say that I'm always learning, but I never lost that intellectual curiosity. I love to learn. She encouraged us to open a safer and learn. She felt that women, you know, are exposed to so much secularly, and they should as much or more so be intellectually curious when it came to Sifrei Kodesh. So that was always a big value that she instilled in us.
Do you think that's a unique perspective in your experience, or is that a typical of a seminary and of people who teach women, and they encourage a lifelong commitment to
Yeah, I don't think it's part for the course. There are a lot of seminaries who don't necessarily push that. You know, they're more hashkafa based, or, you know, they're more outside text. She was very strong on actually really delving into the text and, you know, learning Mefarshim, learning other Svarim inside. So that was, you know, she was very much...
It's really interesting to me, because when I think of, like, the most yeshivish person is BJJ, right? It's like the Frumist Seminary and Rebbetzin David. And, like, that almost sounds not so yeshivish or more edgy in a modern way to empower women to engage in the Torah intellectually. It's like, yeah, to me, the opposite of yeshivish.
It's a very yeshivish approach. You know, I was exposed, Baruch Hashem, to great Litvish women, wives of Rosh Yeshiva, the wife of Reb Mordechai Shulman, who was my father's, Zatzal, who was my father's Rebbe. You know, she was still alive when I was in seminary. I would go to Slabatka Yeshiva and for Yontif, for Shabbos here and there. She knew Tanakh by heart. Mm. So if you're blind towards the end of her life, but if you would tell her the Parsha, she would recite the corresponding Haftorah by heart.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, so... there were women that were like that in my life. And she was very, if you read about the women of Tells, you know, Mishpach Magazine had a great article.
An amazing article about
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So, and interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, we had a who's who. In my year in BJJ, we had a who's who in terms of daughters, granddaughters of Rosh Yeshiva, two granddaughters of Rav Chaim Stein, Zatzal, and I had a daughter of Rav Feigelstadt from Long Beach Yeshiva, and I had a daughter of Rabbi Charlap before you. Like, we had just, you know, really a who's who, and Rebbetzin David loved that. You know, she just she would remind, you know, people who they were. But, you know, she really loved the developing that intellectual curiosity. She loved the people, you know, coming up with their own viewpoints and debating. And she had a good sense of humor, and she would love if somebody came up with a witty line or, you know, clever something clever. You know, she would, her eyes would sparkle. She was, you know, she was not, people now think, you know, frum, you have to dress all in black and be very austere. She smiled. Her eyes would sparkle. She dressed in color. I remember that she had a particular yellow dress that she wore all the time, you know. She didn't appear to be, you know, a Revitzin. She was, you know, she looked.
It's interesting. You mentioned that she would pull news clips. Do you think she was like reading newspapers at that time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
She was up on everything. She taught us Jewish history. She, you know, her PhD was in history. So
is, I think, right? Something about the Maritzchias?
Taught us 19th and 20th century Jewish history.
Wow.
Mostly focused on the years leading up to the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, the years leading up to the establishment of the state. But, you know, she taught us all about Achad Ha'am and Jacob Dahan, all these, and then, you know, Hajamin Hussein, you know, and all these things that we didn't know, like we didn't learn these things before. But she you know, she really, they came alive in her classes.
That's amazing.
Yeah. She, you know, and things were nuanced. It wasn't like the Medina's all bad. And this is, you know, like she taught in a very nuanced way. There were good or bad things. There were, you know, she wanted us to be knowledgeable. That was the import. That was the message.
Think of her in your life now. Do you have moments when you think of her, other than when you correct?
Yeah. So you
language?
Know, I don't know that I think of her all the time, but certain things, you know, kind of just bring back memories. I guess the war now in Eretz Yisrael brought back memories of Eretz Yisrael. I remember we also learned with her. We also learned Shemona Prakim La Rambam. I remember loving that with, you know, as she taught it.
Did she invite you guys into her house, into her home life, or is it like a separate thing?
So the only time we went to her home was during our individual meetings with her. Yeah. The end of the year, that's the only time I was in her
apartment. Her husband wasn't really, it wasn't like a family
No. I don't think she invited students for Shabbos meals. I don't know. You know, she was the kind of person where she didn't really initiate relationships, but if you pursued it with her, then she was very open to it. So,
yeah. That was a shita or a personality?
I think it was more of a personality. She was, again, very private person. Approached her, you know, she was open to it, but it's not like she pursued it, you know, aside, but she did make it a point to meet with all of us individually, which I think is very, very special.
Did you keep in touch with her or connect with her over the last bunch of years?
I got married pretty quickly. I had three children in under 3 years. Wow. I was working the whole time. I was like, my life was consumed with survival.
Okay. Yeah.
Back. They also, you know, you had to sit and write a letter. You know, it wasn't me. There was no email. There was no.
When I hear about her, I can't help but to think about her father, Rav Huttner, and the kinds of relationships he had and the great influence that he had on people. I wonder if, in your sense, she followed that model of really getting deep in with people and really influencing them through. He had a little more charisma, I believe, is what I've heard, but. You know, do you feel she was modeling herself after him in any way, or do you have any way to know?
It's interesting because I don't know what I wrote to my grandparents during the Gulf War, but a letter that I have to this day from my grandfather said he could see the stamp of Rav Huttner in me.
Wow.
Based on what I wrote, and he said that's a good thing. So, you know. Would write to me in Hebrew, in Lashon HaKodesh, but that's what he wrote. So I would love to see my letter, you know, my 32 years ago or whatever, to him. I don't have that letter, but I have the letter back. So, you know,
that's really fascinating.
Yeah,
I mean, she had such a rich upbringing because. Right. She was the only child of this great Gadol, right. And she spent a lot of time. I know she wrote over his Torah or whatever role she played, and she had a tremendous saturation of that world.
Right.
You know,
I will add that Rebbetzin David, she set very high expectations for us in terms of you know, intellectual rigor in terms of comportment, in terms of, and I'll tell you a little story about that, just in terms of behavior, in terms of idealism, in terms of our goals and our values and where we want to strive for in life. She didn't talk about it much, but it was kind of understood. And she very rarely, I can't remember many times at all that she took any kind of punitive approach. I don't remember anybody getting punished. I don't, you know, it was just, this is the bar and this is what I expect of you. You know, that was the message. One time when I ran, I'm always running late. One time when I ran from the dorm building to the school's about a mile, and, you know, I guess I was running and I slipped and I fell really hard, and my knee was like torn open, bleeding. Anyway, so I hobbled the rest of the way to school. And Rabbi Sadeva did not often do this, but she was standing outside the classroom door that day. And as I'm running in, and she said, Sarah Tenenbaum, your sock is sagging a little bit. So there was no skin showing, but my sock was, please go back to the dorm and change your socks. So I'm like, okay. I figured, okay, if I'm going to hobble back to the dorm, I'm going to take the rest of the day off, you know.
Wow. I
borrow my knee from that fall. So, you know, I went back, I cleaned myself up, I ended up resting. I couldn't walk on that knee that day. But, you know, she never mentioned that I didn't come back.
That's great.
I went for it. But she got her message across.
Interesting. Wow. All right. Well, is there anything else you want to share? I really appreciate you giving us a perspective that's lasted all these years. It's amazing how a person can have such impact.
On us, without, you know, like I said, without fiery speeches, without punishment, without anything. She just really set the bar very high and kind of expected us to, I don't know if I'm worthy of it, but, you know, that's the kind of, she expected great things of us also.
Well, I can say to those listening that you play a very important role in our community, and you have for many years, and you and your husband together have really built something special here in Houston, and I'm proud to be part of it. So whatever role she played in giving you that vision and aspirational view on what Klal Yisrael and what a community could be, I think we're all benefiting from it. So
thank you very much, Roy Garfield. Okay, it's a pleasure.
All the best. Have a great day. Once again, we're able to hear with Dr. Nagel how vibrant and relevant the messages of Rebbetzin David are today in her life, even though she had her as a teacher and was in BJJ so many years ago. The final interview is with Mrs. Revi Rattenberg, whose main name is Geldworth. She attended BJJ from 2007 to 2008. And once again, you hear such thoughtful reflections on this 1 year of her life, but that truly impacted her thinking, her gisha, her approach to Avodas Hashem, and we get to hear another perspective so many years later on Rebbetzin David and her teaching methodology. Hello, it's a pleasure to have another Talmidah of Rebbetzin David here, Mrs. Revi Rattenberg of Houston, Texas. Good morning, Mrs. Rattenberg.
Good morning, Rabbi Garfield. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I'm so happy you're here because we want to get another perspective of the Rebbetzin. And so the question I have for you is, where did you go to high school and why did you choose BJJ as the seminary for you?
I went to high school in Brooklyn, New York, Beis Yaakov High School. When I was in high school, going to seminary was not necessarily a given. So I don't think I specifically chose BJJ. I think I chose going to Israel for the year. And then that was the primary decision. And then the secondary decision was, so to speak, where to go. I didn't really have much familiarity.
Interesting. And did you have any perception of Rebbetzin David before? Like, was she part of that? Or were you excited to meet her?
She was definitely part of that. I was familiar with her larger than life reputation as an exceptionally uniquely brilliant, uniquely accomplished woman. She always had this mystique about her reputation. I knew some of her husband's family in New York. My family had a close relationship with them, and I often heard her reference. So that might have added like another layer of familiarity.
Interesting.
But I can't say specifically that was the draw.
Okay.
As it should have been.
Right. All right, good. It's always nice to have pleasant surprises down the road. And so tell me about your first meeting with her.
So the interview process in BJJ was another BJJ thing, or maybe more accurately, a Rebbetzin David thing that was very talked up. From what I remember, most of the girls who were interviewing, those that I knew beforehand, those waiting in the waiting room, were very intimidated. Yeah, I guess you could say that interviews are inherently a stressful thing, but this was disproportionately so, even amongst the non-nervous type.
I assume she changed it up, because if she did the same thing for everyone, there'd be a file on what to expect.
Exactly. I would attribute that to being the predominant factor that was unpredictable, and you couldn't really prepare for it. You know, people, girls usually would share their war stories, and everyone would ask people before about their interview stories, and it really ran the gamut.
Yeah, that's great.
Girls who had uneventful, almost like disappointingly so, interviews, and others who were really challenged.
Did you have to prepare in any way? Did they tell you, like, prepare something, or you just go in there blind, ready to go?
Well, they tell you that she's going to ask you about a Ramban, but I think that is not something you can adequately prepare for.
Right.
I don't think that there was a certain, you know, group of predictable testing material that she used. I don't remember that being the case.
Got it.
So, no, she had no interest in canned answers, and she made that clear. So there wasn't a way to prepare. And she also wasn't this warm and fuzzy type. She didn't make a concerted effort to make you comfortable. Not in a negative way. That just wasn't her style across the board.
Got it. Okay, so you go in there. Was it one-on-one, or were there multiple people?
No, it was one-on-one. And most of it was uneventful. I don't remember the academic portion that much, so I'm assuming it was uneventful. But I remember her asking me about my hobbies. She asked me what I do. She asked me, are you a reader? And I right away said yes. And then she followed up with, what was the name of the last book that you read?
Ooh, awkward.
Well, it didn't have to be, but apparently it was. I hesitated for too long, and I remember her very clearly looking at me and saying, you are definitely not struggling to remember the last book that you read. You're struggling to remember the last book that you want to share with me that you read.
Nice.
And thankfully, I just quickly responded something like, I can absolutely remember the last book that I read. And I left it at that, and she nodded. And I think she appreciated that more than if I would have gotten flustered or, you know, made up a book.
And she didn't press you for the book, which is impressive too.
I don't remember, but I think that had I, you know, gone with the quote unquote appropriate book to repeat to Rebbetzin David on a seminary interview, that wouldn't have been appreciated.
Right. Very nice. Baruch Hashem, you got in, I guess, obviously. And off you go to Eretz Yisrael. Did you know other girls going, or were you on your own pretty much?
I knew other girls going.
Okay, so you went with the Shtickl Chevra, and when you got there, was she one of the teachers, or how did that work?
So she taught all the classes. I believe the seminary was divided into three classes at the time, and she taught all of us Jewish history, and she taught two of the three classes Chumash. So I had her for Chumash and for Jewish history, which she referred to as Historia.
And so let's talk about those classes. The Jewish history one sounds very interesting. What was that? What part of Jewish history that cover?
So she mostly focused on Yishev Haaretz and gave us a lot of contextual background. And really her starting point was 1948, or the development of the State of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked at it not so much as a compilation of, you know, historical names, figures, dates, that kind of history curriculum, as much as a worldview and trying to elevate the level of discussion or the worldview that we had from very elementary to more sophisticated.
Was that different than you experienced in the Heilige Beis Yaakov of Borough Park? I would think that they would try to inculcate you with certain hashkafas already. So was it like a different hashkafa than you had in high school?
It's not so much that the hashkafa was different. It's about that the focus was different. I had wonderful historia teachers, particularly in high school, all who stand out as being really having an impact and have been really, really, really highly competent and excellent at what they did. But the lens was definitely, which is, I agree, is extremely important, because you can't get to the higher level without you can't just go with your feelings on what you want to be with having no springboard. So they were definitely foundational, and I wouldn't have been able to appreciate Rebbetzin David's perspective without them. But it would be correct to say that one worldview was presented. It wasn't limited, but one worldview was presented. It was presented with the focus of the Jewish experience and a compilation of information. which in itself was to me fascinating, but not necessarily to every, to somebody who history isn't their favorite subject. But St. David Engel was very unique. She brought primary sources. She would come in with these old faded newspaper clippings that looked like they were museum artifacts. She jumped across centuries because she was trying to teach us about a pattern in Jewish history and how that integrates into our Jewish identity and how not to just look at our lived experience and develop a viewpoint based on that, but to read books on opposite ends of the spectrum. And that was unique to not necessarily my experience, but to the curriculum experience.
It would be really cool, just as we're talking, I'm thinking if someone would write it up in a book form. I don't know if that's possible with the different sources and the insights and the patterns. I mean, she would probably not go for that, but I'm sure there's a wealth of great information there.
What do you mean by not go for that?
To write? I don't know. She seemed to like want to keep her teaching privacy. Personal. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a book is like the most public. It's out for anyone who can read it. Like, I don't know, that seems to be not necessarily her approach.
It wasn't her approach. I think that you had to be a willing and able participant for her to engage with you.
So we'll make the book really expensive. How's that? The book costs like $200, then you only buy it if you're going to actually read it. I'm curious, she has an academic background. She has a doctorate, I believe, from Columbia, I think, in Jewish history. And I'm wondering how that influenced, if it did at all, her teaching of history, her style, any references to that. Like, I guess I could say it like this. If you didn't know that, would you have picked it up, having seen her in action?
It's not something I could have picked up without information, because I think that her scope and her viewpoint was so beyond that. It made sense with who she was. She was a free thinker. So she wouldn't have necessarily been limited by, you know, traditional paths for which whatever it was for a girl who was graduating high school at that time. But that's not to say that she was progressive. I think that she was very far from that in her worldview. I think it was more that she was such a unique free thinker that she wasn't limited and didn't necessarily limit herself from any viewpoint or sources or resources that she felt would further her goal. And I don't think she felt that way toward her students and their goals. But it's also important to say that I don't think she would hold somebody else who held her level of degree in esteem simply because they held that degree. They prove themselves worthy as a person with their level of intellect based on their own merit. And she wanted to encourage us to have that same viewpoint. And it went vice versa. Don't limit yourself because you think X, Y, or Z is wrong. And don't prescribe unwarranted merit to it. I think she felt like you could have the same degree as her and be a fool. And you can be that much more accomplished without it.
Wow. Probably because she lived with people and was surrounded by people of high stature who it was just a non-starter for her, you know, and she
exactly
saw what it was.
It wasn't a matter of respect of intellect. I think she engaged with people on such a high caliber, as you said, that it was almost elementary.
Right. Not saying- right. It's funny. I'm thinking as you were talking, like a muscle maybe would be like where I went to high school doesn't really matter. It's nice. But that's not what I'm about. That doesn't define me necessarily. Happened to be, I went to an awesome high school, but that's a different story. And so, okay, you went there for high school. You went to seventh grade in a certain school. Okay, whatever. Now what?
Exactly. Osma,
you know?
Right.
Okay, and the Chumash, how is that different or similar to the history class?
It was completely different learning style, I think, based on the content. It was much more text-based. And therefore, probably it wasn't as open-ended. So you had to really commit yourself. It took a lot more work in the sense that she held her students responsible for a vast amount of content, and her standard was very high. It wasn't an open-ended conversation, which is what a philosophical course is like. So it played to different strengths.
Were there any mefarshim that she relied on more heavily than others?
The Sefer HaChinuch extensively, Gor Aryeh, and then all the mefarshim that you see in.
What about the Sefer HaChinuch? What was that, like the Taimei HaMitzvos type of thing?
Yeah, because we were learning those parashios that were specific, and she was, her standard was that she would take a word in any mefarsh, or a phrase, three words in any mefarsh that we had learned covering in the span of a couple of prakim. It could have been 80 different topics, and she would give three words, and she would say, Minayin. And that was the level of ownership she wanted you to have on what. So it was a big commitment.
Wow.
I mean, for some people, it came naturally to them. I can't claim to be one of those girls at all.
You can't be good at everything, Mrs. Rottenberg. You cannot be good at everything.
I think everyone had to work, but you had to have a very good memory for that to not require a lot of it.
So did she have a specific tzura or a form that she wanted her students to take in terms of who they married, where they lived, what they did, that she professed, like, everyone should be married in Kollel and go to teach?
She definitely didn't. That was not her language, not because of the message as much as she did not. I think she would have considered that outright message as talking down to her audience.
Ooh-ah.
Not because of the message, that style of this is right, therefore do this. This is the way to do it. I think that she tried to, she always elevated the conversation. She started from a place that was like 8 wavelengths above us. And she was crystal clear. She was an excellent orator. She was very clear at giving over her ideas. But what she hoped to accomplish was giving us a more sophisticated worldview by talking about our identity, our goals, what makes us alive, what's important to us. And I don't think she felt that there was a specific profile that is ascribed to. I think she, she was much more open than that. I don't think she was limited to that at all.
I'm hoping that the Rabbanu Shel Olam has the same approach, right? I mean, looking at the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu there's not one way to serve Hashem. As long as you are fulfilling the higher level calling of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and having your Shemayim and Bikayim the Mitzvahs, you could do anything. I mean, there's no limitation. It's not only for Kli Kodesh. Plumbers also have the same opportunity in Ruchnias, I assume. So maybe that's a similar Ashkafa.
Absolutely. And I think that this is coming from a person who probably had an extraordinary respect for that lifestyle. So it wasn't coming from any indifference as much as there was nothing superficial about her at all. There was no casual to her. She had people describe intense people. She was, in my mind, the very definition of intensity. The things that mattered that much. And she wanted us to become people of substance and to be people of substance and to respect that. She would have dismissed surface definitions that she thought that people would say some a person.
Did she talk about her father a lot?
Very often. She referenced him. She quoted him. Not necessarily in a personal sense, as much more in a
source of Torah.
Yes, constantly.
Wow. Because I don't know a whole lot about the Rosh Hashiva of Huttner, but there certainly seems to be a lot of parallels in the way he treated his Talmidim and this idea of striving for higher and holding yourself to a certain standard and the respect that he treated his Talmidim with and that he expected the Talmidim to treat him. Again, not forced respect, per se, but more of just like a sense of the greatness of what we're doing, a sense of urgency, like this is serious business, you know?
Yeah, all that was a function of self-respect that she wanted, right. And I'm sure he wanted his students to have for themselves.
Right, which pushes them to higher.
Exactly, it was an atmosphere that she tried to create.
Why do you think there are so many Talmidos who are in Kli Kodesh then? I mean, so many of her Talmidos are teachers, I think, you know, that's my impression.
I can't speak to that. I don't know. I really don't know. I do think that she drew an academic crowd based on some of the standards or the prerequisites. So it might follow that academic interests might go into academia, or at least it did then. But I can't speak to more.
Do you remember her ever getting excited or triggered? Like, what were things that really got her going?
I can remember a lot of situations where she was passionate in the classroom, but something that specifically stands out, especially this time of year, she repeated to us that one of us, a student, made a reference during, she's talking about Hanukkah and Eretz Yisrael, someone made a reference about missing home and a certain coziness in the atmosphere this time of year, and she really pressed them on it. Mm-hmm. And the student admitted to that certain New York City, Macy's, Home Alone culture of this season.
Right.
And she was incensed. And what might have been predictable was that that was coming from a place that she was upset that we were exposed to that or familiar with that. But that really wasn't what the root of it was. Her real indictment wasn't coming from a sense that you shouldn't be exposed or familiar with that. It was really coming from a deep disappointment. she understood that in order to connect good feelings or like positive associations with Christmas or that season, then you best case scenario had to be too ignorant or worst case scenario, too disconnected to hold place for the fact that in the name of this day, Jews throughout Jewish history literally took under hiding. Jews in Eastern Europe, Jews during the Middle Ages, this was the incitement for calls of pogrom and how many thousands of Jews, forget about what this day started. Like you can, she's not even talking about attributing the Spanish Inquisition or the Crusades. She said, are you too ignorant or too disconnected to know that your great-great-grandparents hid for fear of their lives? And wow, you could either be so ignorant or overlook it to feel that sense of coziness. Like she couldn't reconcile that. And especially in our white wavelength, the response might be, well, lighten up. They're not talking about mass right. murder. They're talking about a parade.
Right.
But she didn't want it to be so easy for us to make those disconnections. Of course, she could intellectualize that as well.
Do you remember any personal interactions you had with her where she either gave you feedback or not criticism? You don't have to share that, but, you know, some kind of personal insight that you remember?
I do. So I would say the memory that stands out, because probably it was my first interaction with her that was on a personal level. When we first came to BJJ, we had, and the first testing season came about, so I had a Chumash test, and immediately followed, I think we had a Historia test. And the Chumash test, I thought I had put in reasonable effort, or what was reasonable effort to me in the past years, and I did miserably. I think I barely passed, and I thought I put in good work, and I just accepted it, you know, that, you know, I was entering a new stage, and this, you know, I was out of my league. And I kind of moved on. And then the Jewish history test came about, and I very much appreciated the testing style. Her testing style, she'd give a source from a period that we discussed, something that she'd never referenced in class, and said, which political party, a member of which political party do you think might have written that newspaper article?
Wow.
And she wanted us to expound on that. And I very much enjoyed that test, and I did considerably better. And she called me over afterwards, and she said to me, I have rarely seen such a discrepancy or a chasm in intelligence in one student. Are both of these yours? And I think it was something like, I don't know if it was the highest and lowest grade in her Chumash class, Chumash versus Historia class, but it might have been. And I appreciated it.
Wow.
Because she was telling me it's easy to do things that come naturally to you. Put in effort. Clearly you don't have a great memory. Work harder.
That's really nice. I think that can only work if it comes from a real respect of others. Like you felt, I'm sure, that she genuinely respected you and she wasn't trying to put you down or be disrespectful.
Well, there was nothing unnecessary. She was a very sharp person, but she was never biting for the sake of being biting. So she right. was never unnecessarily harsh. I can't say that I think she respected me at that time. I think she respected me on the level that all human beings deserve respect, but respect had to be earned.
Oh, okay.
And the sign that she was engaging was a mark of at least a starting point for success,
right,
but I don't think
right.
she respected me.
Just a little side point. You mentioned the newspaper clippings, and I think I heard that before. Do you think she kept up with reading the newspaper or other non-Torah contemporary readings in her life?
I don't think I have to venture a guess. She brought in current materials all the time. So I would imagine that it wasn't just, you know, someone dropped off a newspaper clipping that they felt was relevant for her. I think she was extensively well-read, and I think she consumed all information that interested her.
It's amazing to me that she didn't address that directly, which is, I guess, consistent with her whole approach. Is like, if I had a Rosh Hashiva who was reading the newspaper, who had a doctorate in history, I'd want him to talk about it. Like, why did you do that? What's that about? What's your aspiration for me? But it sounds like that all was just like not relevant. That was like a side part.
It wasn't the playing field that she even operated on. If there was something of value, she shared it. And I don't think that to her, what I think was disappointing to her was when girls identified with the what she considered to be the dumbed down version of outside culture that had no relevance, had no meaning. She was an intensely intellectual, academic person. And she had no regard for that whatsoever in terms of like her personal experience. But anything that had what to offer, I think wow. she would be surprised by the question.
Right.
That's what I would imagine.
Yeah, that's great.
She also used terms and referenced social movements in school that weren't new or surprising to me, but were kind of taboo in my elementary and high school years. And I saw it as a sign of her engaging in adult conversations and wanting us to have viewpoints on things that were actually happening. Like, she couldn't just discuss things that weren't relevant.
Wow. Have you ever met anyone that reminded you of her? A Rav or Shiva or a...
No.
A Chaneves?
No. No.
Unique.
Entirely unique.
Wonderful.
I've also never met people who can maintain such a traditional, old school worldview and have such a sense of openness and clarity and willingness to engage. There was no off-limit. I asked her a question once that I remember being a little bit embarrassed to ask because I thought maybe she judged me for it. And she was so nonchalant and face value in her response. And it was so eye-opening to me. I mean, I knew of a from student of hers from many years back who maintained completely not religious and maintained an extremely close connection with her up until the end. And that to me spoke volumes about, you know, people described her as distant, but she wasn't a distant intellectual. She was passionate about all things she believed. And she very much, she appreciated students from diverse backgrounds. And I think that on some level, she respected them from the get-go, that they were there, because she hated all religious or spiritual complacency. And that spoke to the fact, just the fact that they were there already put them on a footing that spoke something about their journey.
Yeah.
But she wasn't either dishonest enough to credit them just with their diversity, meaning she would have taken somebody from the most cookie cutter backgrounds. And if you impressed her and had original and what didn't have to be original. It was a straight, like the Yiddish word glatt, that she hated corrupt thinking that was based on a false premise or like what we would call modern day virtue signaling. She was like allergic to that.
Wow.
So to her, it was about, yeah, like intellectual honesty.
Are there any other anecdotes or incidents that you think typify her approach that you would share?
There's something that stood out that I found very striking. I don't know if it was approach to life as much as an approach to the way it was eye-opening as how uniquely, it wasn't about how unique, but how she wanted us to look at things from a wider lens. I remember her discussing the age of Haskalah, and she was talking about a certain maskil who was very problematic for Jews and some of the challenges that Jews faced as a result. And she took the conversation away and she said, girls, I have to give credit for somebody who was 18 or 19 years old at that time period, who read a book and uprooted their life based on that book. Do you know what a deep-seated conviction somebody has to do? They're probably going to be disowned by their family and community. And even if he was entirely wrong in his viewpoint, how many of you would give up your life because a book resonated with you? Wow. What makes us stray? Is it ideas or is it entirely something else?
That's really amazing. I think that's a great place to stop and to let people just sit with that. And the next time we read something, let's think about Revitson David and allow it to really impact us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Appreciate it.
I'm so thankful to our four guests for taking the time to speak with me, as probably is yet another reflection of Revitson David. None of them approached this interview flippantly. Each one asked for time to prepare, was very thoughtful in their answers, and really took the work of trying to share some insights into Revitson David with you very seriously. So we appreciate their preparation and their thoughtfulness as I prepared with them these interviews. I hope you got to start to get a glimpse into Revitson David. I myself feel we were just scratching the surface, which is how she did it, how she wanted it, how she designed it. So that's all we're going to get, what she was able to provide. But between the four different perspectives over time, I think we did get a beginning of an insight into who she was, how much she valued learning, women's roles, and, you know, giving it over to the next generation. Thank you so much for joining us for the longest episode of Chinuch Today ever. So I hope that's okay. I guess if you're still with us, it is. And for those of you who are still with us, I'm going to share with you a very exciting announcement. We will be launching Pesach Time, a new podcast, together with my dear friend, Rabbi Ari Schoenfeld. The new podcast is being hosted by Mishpacha Magazine, and it's called The Learning Curve. It is very different than Chinuch Today. Chinuch Today focuses on fascinating people and ideas in Chinuch, and the Learning Curve with Rabbi Ari Schoenfeld is more about issues. It's tackling some of the big issues, and it's a lot of fun. We recorded a bunch of them already, and I'm so thankful for Mishpacha Magazine for taking us on. It's going to be a great collaboration, and I hope that our many, many fans from Chinuch Today are also going to enjoy the Learning Curve and continue to share our podcast. Because as you know, anyone who listens to Chinuch Today knows that sharing is caring. Please feel free to send any questions, comments, or suggestions for guests to chinuchtodaypodcast@gmail.com. Wishing you all the best. This is Yerachmiel Garfield. Have a wonderful day.